We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28, and to donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, July 7th, and I think we are all still basking in the glow of America 250 and all of the celebrations over the weekend. And, you know, I hope that that lasts for a really long time. I love the focus and the emphasis on our founding, on where we have come from as a great country. I mean, 250 years, relatively speaking, in a nation's history is not that long, but what America has accomplished and what we've become from what we started from over 250 years is truly incredible. And there really is no nation like America because we were founded on the premise and the recognition of truth, that our rights come from God, our Creator, and it is the sole legitimate purpose of government to preserve and protect those rights. And it's amazing to see what a nation can accomplish when we acknowledge God. And conversely, it's amazing how fast a nation can fall when we reject God and when we do not acknowledge truth and when we actively reject those premises. And we were talking yesterday about the differences between Donald Trump's speech, the vision for America under a true framework of freedom, and conversely, what Zoran Mamdani said from New York and his vision for America under this socialist, communist, which are an outflow of a Marxist worldview that is a specific rejection of truth, of God, of the rights of the people that come from God, our Creator, and how those two different worldviews right now are clashing in America in our two parties, in our two political parties, the GOP and the Democrats. And the GOP really needs to wrestle with this because, of course, the Democrats are not going to. They are basically openly embracing this. They're suggesting, all of their leaders are saying, hey, we're a big tent, you know, come on. And I think that is a very telling lesson that the GOP needs to learn, that while we've been saying for a while on the right, oh yeah, it's a big tent and, you know, this is great, just come and vote for the GOP, but it doesn't actually matter if you assimilate into our worldview. This is how then the Republican Party starts tacitly advocating less for things like pro-life, for a traditional biblical marriage, for the family, and kind of letting some of those things slide because of how big the party gets. And then we get people who are running on a Republican platform that then don't actually represent the worldview of truth and of what the right should be standing for, which is a conservative worldview that's built upon a biblical worldview. But the Democrats are facing the same thing and even worse because of this socialist infiltration into their party. And Speaker Mike Johnson was asked by Shannon Bream on Fox News Sunday this last Sunday, right after America 250, about communism sweeping the country. And he addressed first his thoughts on America 250, but then I want you to listen to his full response about how he believes the GOP needs to respond to this. This is cut one.
Joining us now, House Speaker Mike Johnson. Speaker, great to have you back with us.
Glad to be with you.
All right, your thoughts on 250 into this experiment?
It's amazing. We are celebrating the greatest nation the world has ever seen, and it was full of activities and events here in Capitol Hill this weekend. We were up till over after 2 a.m. Two nights in a row and could have kept going. The president was excited to deliver that speech in spite of the elements last night, and he told me backstage before he went out there, Mike, there's no way we could have postponed this. I said, you're right, sir. It was really well done.
Yeah, there were thousands of people who were willing to come back despite multiple evacuations, to be there for all of the festivities last night. The president touched on something. He touched on this idea of the return of communism. And I know that you've talked about this, too. Democrats are having to grapple with who's calling the shots in their party as these Democratic Socialist members are having great success. But Steve Bannon said some interesting things to Politico this week that neither Republicans nor Democrats really fully grasp what they're dealing with here. He says this: if you're playing the old politics of tax cuts and wars everywhere and doing the bidding of Israel, his words, let me be blunt, you're finished. I just keep telling people it's a flashing red light, and the Senate Majority Leader John Thunes of the world and House Speaker Mike Johnson better understand that the old politics are gone. Your response?
Well, Steve needs to see what we've been saying. I've been saying this for years and on the campaign trail for over a year and a half. And since Mamdani got elected in New York, I've been out on the campaign trail countrywide across coast to coast, every swing district, the blue states, red states, saying the same thing. There are many Mamdanis popping up running for Congress around the country, and you better be very serious about this. This is a serious threat to our whole system of government. These are Marxists. It's communism, socialism. Those are deviations of Marxism. Begins with the opposite premise of America, and it is a serious threat to us. These people want to say, they're saying it out loud, they want to abolish all borders. They want to abolish all prisons. They want to defund the police. They want to abolish the U.S. Senate. They want to pack the Supreme Court. They want the government to take over control of all production. This is communism, and it has led to the murder of innocent people, tens of millions of them in the 20th century alone. We have to fight this. We're no longer just in an election cycle. We were saying it was common sense versus crazy. Now it's common sense versus communism, and everybody needs to wake up.
Well, you talk about all the things that they're for, and the Democrats are having to have this internal fight over how much of this they're going to allow. They keep saying that they have a big tent, but do you think they internally understand what their party is facing?
I think quietly the Democrat establishment on Capitol Hill understands that, but they feel powerless to stop it, because if they stand up and say this is wrong, the problem they have is the energy, the excitement, the money, the grassroots is on the side of the insurgent left. And this is a threat that we have never seen before in the elected system of our government. Ronald Reagan used to warn about communism. He talked about it, that it was a distant threat across the world, and now the barbarians are inside the gate. So this election cycle is for all the marbles, Shannon. This is not your father's Democrat Party. That party's long gone.
Wow. Well, let's welcome in Ed Vitagliano, who is our executive vice president of the American Family Association and also a co-host that I join frequently, one of the guys on today's issue. So, Ed, thanks so much for joining me this morning. And do you think that Steve Bannon is right that Republicans haven't really figured out how to respond to this threat? We know the Democrats haven't, and they're not gonna, but have Republicans not figured it out?
Yeah, I think, by the way, thanks. Love being on with you, Jenna. I think there are a couple of things that are in play here. So the quick answer is no, I don't think the Republicans have come to grips with this yet. Part of the problem, I think, for both political parties, but increasingly, you touched on this in your opening comments, for conservatives and the Republican Party, for the last, maybe 25, 26 years, the Republicans have moved from a principled party that upholds conservative values, including things like fiscal responsibility. They've moved from being able to quickly identify and represent their principles and defending them to a party that is more interested in winning elections and being more willing to throw out those kind of defining principles. I think part of the reason for that was the unexpected success of Bill Clinton in the 1990s. And I think that Republicans said, well, we're going to have to start promising people a lot of stuff if we want them to vote for us. The danger is, kind of like the old expression, if you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything. If we cannot, as a conservative movement and in the Republican Party, if its leaders cannot define what conservatism is and be able to express why it's best for America that we embrace those conservative principles, then we won't have ammunition for fighting movements like we are seeing rapidly developing inside the Democratic Party. And then I would say that the word, second of all, the word communism has been used as a boogeyman for so long, rightly so, because for much of the, 20th century, it was a threat to human existence on the planet. But sometimes these things, it's like tossing around the word Nazi. People get tired of hearing it. It's like tossing around the word racist. People get tired of hearing it. And it doesn't carry as much weight. And I think for Republicans, they've been slow to understand that this is an actual threat internally in the United States from a communist movement. For so long, communism was out there, was outside our borders. And now it is gaining some traction inside. And with young people being so dissatisfied with our country, having been taught for a couple of generations now that our country is built on faulty principles, it's racist, it's imperialist, this is a real threat. And I think Republicans have been slow to the party.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more, Ed Vitagliano, because Republicans for too long have not been the leaders. We've been the tacit followers, and those in D.C. have followed a lot of what the Democrat regime has been advocating for in this sense, that when the Democrats are talking about affordability and using that as a buzzword, for example, then the Republicans suddenly are all talking about that. Instead of saying, well, we've been the ones who are advocating for capitalism all along, and explaining that framework and why that is the best framework for liberty and for prosperity and for private property and all of these values that are intrinsic in a biblical worldview that then outflows to conservatism, because conservatives should be conservatives because we understand that the Bible is true. You can be a conservative without being a Christian, but then ultimately your worldview falls short. And I think this is the problem with Republicans, is that their worldview is falling short. They are only advocating for what they see are the ends of freedom, but they're not really seeing what the means have been for the last 250 years.
Oh, that's absolutely, absolutely true. You know, I think Republicans, and maybe some of this, in talking about the Republican establishment, maybe some of this is because Republicans have been embarrassed about social conservatives. Okay, we have argued for decades and decades and decades against abortion, for the sanctity of marriage, against the sexual revolution, and especially its maybe most potent expression in the homosexual movement. And I think Republican establishment leaders, party leaders, have been embarrassed. We're the cranky uncle. And so and when you have like a Tea Party movement, they don't like upsetting the apple cart. They get embarrassed at people who are fervent in their defense of conservative principles and of, the rights protected by the Bill of Rights. And so I think they have been embarrassed about the Christian wing of the conservative movement. And as a result, I think they've kind of held that at arm's length. And I wonder, I don't know how many actual Christian leaders have been in charge of the party establishment for the last 40 years. But the problem, as you've outlined here, is that if you eject the Christian roots to our country, from our country and from the conservative movement and undergirding capitalism, how do you make a defense of capitalism if you do not talk about the human rights that come from God? If you don't talk about the fact that the ownership of private property is not only a God-given right, but it is in part the means that God has given to humankind to make the world a better place. How do you explain your commitment if you don't appeal to God and you don't appeal to our Christian roots? All you can do is say, well, hey, you can get rich. How about that? Well, that's not going to be much of an answer for people who want to eat the rich.
Yeah, so well said. And this is why secular pluralism in our society, as it applies to the outflow of our worldview on faith, is so dangerous, because what we're doing essentially, instead of saying this is truth and this is the only view that is compatible with truth and the reality to which God has presented us, we have now leveled the playing field to a secular humanist worldview, which is another word essentially for pluralism, that any worldview is equally as valid in theory, and we can argue it coming from an equitable standpoint, and rather than saying, no, here is the objective standard that's outside of man, and our worldview, including our worldview of government, has to be compatible with that. And so anything, any view of the economy, any view of government, any view of civil society that falls short of that, we can automatically reject because it does not fall in line and comport with that standard. And so what we're doing, I think, as conservatives overall, and what the GOP is doing largely, is that they're just arguing on an equal playing field. They're saying, well, you know, if you like capitalism and you want to get rich, vote for us. But then the socialists are saying, but if you want everybody to be equal and they're espousing their view, vote for us. And it's this equal playing field, instead of saying we reject the socialist view because it is inconsistent with the standard of truth and the standard that our society and our U.S. Constitution, by virtue of the Declaration of Independence, requires. And that's a very different view. And I think, Ed, that, you know, as you were talking, I think that the same kind of analogy to how the Republicans and the GOP have sort of failed to pass on their worldview to like the next generation of voters is kind of similar in what you see of some of these, you know, great pastors and church leaders who then their kids unfortunately fall away sometimes and haven't been taught and passed down the principles of truth, even though maybe their fathers were great Christian leaders. And so similarly in politics, if we fail to pass on our understanding of civil government to the next generation, these young people are saying, listen, the establishment of both parties, this uniparty, isn't working. So maybe I'm going to try to vote for a socialist. And they're only thinking this because they haven't been taught how to think through the political framework of what is actually preserving the best form of government for not only my parents, but also for me and then my children and grandchildren. And I think we need to change that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we need to remember, this is not just a failure of conservatives and Republican leaders to pass the torch on and to explain what we believe. On the other side, there has been a willful and purposeful attempt, not just an attempt, they have succeeded over the last 50, 60, 70 years, especially over the last 25 to 30, of purposefully undermining the principles of our republic and refusing to teach the truth. These are educators who have, for the most part, had a tight grip, a monopoly on educating our children, and they have not only refused to teach the truth, but they have inserted lies about our country, or at least twisted the truth. And so you have this kind of double whammy in play, a refusal or a negligence on the part of conservatives to teach the next generation, and you have people on the left intentionally trying to subvert those principles by either not teaching them or twisting the truth. And it is taking its toll. And like you said, these young people have no framework. You've seen the man on the street interviews with these young people. Mm-hmm. They don't have a clue as to what our founders believed. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's like what my mom always says, and I think she's quoting someone else, but it's a great phrase. If you send your children to Caesar, are you really surprised when they come out Romans? I mean, whoever is responsible. Yeah, right. Whoever is responsible for the education and the indoctrination or the training or the teaching, whatever word you want to use, of our young people, that's the framework on which they will view reality. And so this is why the school system, we need to combat as Christians. We need to see all of these different elements that the left has taken over, and we need to reclaim them for the truth and for a biblical worldview that God himself has ordained. Ed Vitagliano, really appreciate it and looking forward to hearing you later on today's issues. Thanks so much, and we'll be right back with more.
America's 250th birthday. It's a great excuse to have some extra cake and ice cream, but we can help your celebration go well beyond that. Show your patriotism with America 250 apparel that will become a memento of this special year. We also have special episodes on AFA Stream to help underscore that America is a Christian nation and help you find God in the Constitution. Find all of this and more in one place. afa.net/topics/250. Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the first day of the preliminary hearing in the Charlie Kirk murder case happened yesterday, and that will continue this week. And there were really no new major revelations in terms of the court proceedings, but it did mark the most significant presentation of evidence to date in the case against the defendant, Tyler Robinson, who is charged with aggravated murder, and the prosecutors are seeking the death penalty in the assassination of Charlie Kirk. And so we heard from former Utah Valley University officer Christopher Bagley. He testified that he witnessed the shooting while Charlie Kirk was speaking to the campus crowds on September 10th of last year. Soon after Bagley testified, he went to a nearby gravel rooftop where it appeared someone had been lying with a clear sight line to Kirk's location, and he said it looked like a sniper pad. There was also some video of various angles. We did learn that the security cameras that belonged to TPUSA and some of those that footage was turned over to police and to law enforcement, and some of that video was not published openly on the live stream, but was part of that hearing. And in one of the most significant moments, in my opinion, that has kind of made the rounds on social media as well, is that while the judge was reviewing this, and I don't think it was likely the first time that he saw this, you could see him just actively flinch and respond to having to witness yet again the heinous footage of what actually happened and Charlie's death. It's so incredibly evil what's going on. So let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel at the Lawfare Project, for more. So Gerard, your take overall on the proceedings so far?
My take is that so far the state is doing what it needs to do and putting on a case for why Tyler Robinson needs to be bound over for trial on these charges. We didn't really see any surprises. I think that the state is meeting its evidentiary burden. It's doing what it needs to do in order to lay out the case, which is enough at this point, I think, to justify the charges going forward.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, of course, the peanut gallery that's on social media and a lot of people who don't even really have a basic understanding of criminal proceedings. I mean, people were calling this, you know, the mini trial, or, you know, some were calling it a show trial, or, you know, completely misunderstanding or not recognizing the purpose of a preliminary hearing. There's a lot of commentary out there that is just so misinformed or doesn't understand the filter of kind of what this this hearing is for. And so one of the things that seemed to be a big deal in the peanut gallery commentary was this fact that the judge was not willing to publish the evidence in the preliminary hearing, the videos at least so far, on the live stream to the general public. And the outcry was, hey, we're not getting to see the evidence, but this is just the preliminary hearing, and the evidence that's admitted here may or may not ultimately be admissible in the actual trial. And so explain why that is, and why I think the judge made the correct call here, of course, not taint the jury pool, but explain for those who may be misled by some of the commentary on social media.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And something else worth adding as well when it comes to video is we already saw that the judge had problems with one of the so-called compilation videos that the state put together, which these are things that you need each video to be authenticated by the person who filmed it or who retrieved it. You need to lay the foundation for admitting things into evidence. And while this is a much lower threshold at a preliminary hearing, by the time you get to trial, we don't even know if all of the evidence will ultimately end up being admissible or admitted, for that matter. So this is still very early days. And when you're talking about a very graphic video, I think the court made the correct call because this was shown to counsel who needs to see it and to the court, not to the spectators. I think that the judge correctly ruled that it was too salacious to show the horrific shot that took Charlie Kirk's life. The audio was on, so the public was able to hear it. And in reality, this is really just a version of a tape that was circulating online that many people unfortunately saw anyway. But it was not meant, this proceeding is not meant to be a jury trial. So the judge wants to be careful not to taint the potential jury pool, which is vast. And because there's so much attention to this case, you want to be more limited in what you're releasing to the public, because by the time you get to trial, that's when the objections really matter. That's when the foundation really matters. And what people are seeing today may not be the same as what is allowed in for a jury to see at trial.
Yeah, and that makes so much more sense than this kind of floating theory and allegation that the judge is somehow, you know, bought off, or he's working with the prosecution and he's suppressing the evidence from the public. I mean, these are just things that sound salacious on social media and maybe go to these conspiracy theories, but really have no basis if you really understand what the proceedings are for and why the judge is making this decision. Because, for example, if he published something that had not been previously made public, and then ultimately that piece of evidence, for whatever reason, it couldn't be authenticated, does not meet the threshold for admission in the actual trial, then that could potentially be an appellate issue later if Tyler Robinson is convicted, that the defense can say, well, potentially, you know, some of the jurors said that they saw this video or they could have seen this video. And so he's foreclosing some potential appeals that on a basis that just makes it more clean instead of totally unnecessary, because we need to remember that the judge here is worried about due process over the public's right potentially to hear the court proceedings. I mean, he's making the rulings, of course, that yes, the public interest matters, but the public interest will never override due process for the defendant.
No, that's right. And you also have to look at who is really the audience of this evidence. When you have a grand jury for an indictment or an initial proceeding, the evidence goes to the grand jury. They're the ones who are meant to see it, not the general public, not anyone else. When you have a preliminary hearing like this, the evidence is really meant to convince the judge. It's not there to convince the general public. So we really are just spectators. And while we do have this presumption of open access to a public hearing and seeing what's going on in the courtroom, there are reasonable limits, especially because the justice system is meant to protect the interests of defendants in terms of process. And we don't want to taint the ability of someone to put on a fair defense just so that the public, who is not the primary recipient of evidence, should get to see it.
Right. And so did you think as well, Gerard Folletti, that the defense did a fair job in terms of their cross-examination, kind of scoring any points? I mean, obviously, their contemplation here is not going to be the same as when it's in front of an actual jury. It's more in line for the defense here. Their goal, likely, because they know that the prosecution will meet their burden of establishing probable cause, it's more to test perhaps some of the weaknesses in the prosecutor's case so that they can build a better theory of the case and where they can poke holes in the prosecution's evidence at trial. So this is basically a way for them to have sort of a free shot at cross-examination of some of the evidence. And one of the things that I found interesting yesterday that the defense focused on was this fact that students are allowed to carry firearms at UVU. And so they made it kind of a big deal about this fact. And some of the commentary, of course, online was like, okay, who cares? But in my view of that, they were probably trying to then negate kind of the video evidence that that if Tyler Robinson had a gun on campus, he was in no different situation than any average student who's carrying anyway. So just the mere fact that he might have possessed a firearm on campus doesn't necessarily mean that he possessed the intent for the murder. And so I just thought that was an interesting piece that the defense was very much focused on that may give us an insight into some of the holes that they're trying to poke for trial.
Right. I think that for the defense, you know that the almost certain outcome is that Tyler Robinson is going to be held over for a trial on these charges. So this is really a chance to do two things. One is to try to indirectly influence a potential jury pool. You want to put as much out there doubt now so that when a jury does sit, they might be confused by what they heard or think that there might be questions or open holes in the case. And so get a leg up on getting a jury that is more favorable. And the other one, as you say, is to poke holes in the prosecution's case, laying questions now that you could also use on cross-examination later if there's any inconsistency, if there's any change, to sow doubt even among professional law enforcement about what they saw or what they remembered or how they did things. So this really is a gift to the defense because it gives them the opportunity to develop useful cross-examination and rebuttal material for trial and at the same time poke holes, not that they'll be effective at getting Tyler released now, but poke holes for later. And the gun part is a very interesting one. I think that we also saw her testimony about an empty holster that was found but then not logged. I think it's kind of previewing a defense strategy where they want to raise the question that, hey, no one actually saw Tyler Robinson shoot Charlie Kirk as far as the prosecution is alleged, so maybe there's doubt as to who actually pulled the trigger. I think that's the foundation that the defense is laying right now.
Yeah, and so then this will all just be circumstantial, and then there's obviously been some issues as well. We learned with one of the officers who testified his body camera, so while he was testifying about what he saw on the roof, that didn't necessarily match exactly the photographs that were presented, and so the defense, of course, is going to exploit all of those things. And so moving ahead to today and the rest of the week, prosecutors have also said that they plan to present DNA evidence linking Robinson to the suspected murder weapon, autopsy findings, witness statements, and more video of Kirk's actual killing. This coming from ABC7. In addition, they're expected to argue that the shooting endangered others at the campus event, which is an aggravating circumstance that could make this punishable by death under Utah law. So they're expected to raise the prosecution today to raise some of those aggravating circumstances that would also bind over the death penalty as the consequence. And so how important is that evidence to moving forward with the death penalty against Tyler Robinson?
Well, I think that evidence is very important because it's really the only basis that the state has for imposing it. It's that endangering others in the act of killing Charlie Kirk that gets you the death penalty. It's, I think, ironic and, in my opinion, unfortunate that the murder itself doesn't qualify for the death penalty, but it's that risk to others that would. So it's key for the prosecution to show the reasonable likelihood that someone could have been killed or injured by Tyler Robinson other than Charlie Kirk in the shooting. And I think generally speaking that when you are shooting in a crowd or near a crowd, that burden is met by the state. So I'd be very surprised if the state didn't have enough evidence to move this part forward. It really does remain to see how the defense questions it and how they try to poke holes at it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see how this proceeds. And one last thing, Gerard Folletti, was we saw that Erica Kirk, of course, Charlie's widow, his parents came to the proceedings. They'll be there all week, and it's just been absolutely horrible to see the comments online and the hatred and the vilification against Erica Kirk. I think that is wrong. It is demonic when we're talking about, you know, some of the vilification from people like Candace Owens, who are just, you know, spouting all of this vitriol. And even just the kind of salacious twisting, like Donald Trump Jr. came as well and was there in support of Erica and Charlie's parents. And of course, then people were suggesting that, you know, oh, I didn't know that Erica and Don Jr. knew each other that well. Well, Charlie was a very, very close friend of Don Jr. I mean, that's how Charlie got his start, was working for Don Jr. And so, of course, he's going to be there to support Erica. And I am just so tired of all of these, you know, ridiculous commentators that are just trying to push out these salacious comments that have no basis in fact, just to get these kind of clicks and views and go viral, instead of focusing on justice for Charlie. And so, you know, for everyone who's listening, we really need to pray and focus on justice for Charlie, pray for the court, for the eventual jury that's going to be selected, and, you know, pray for Erica and Charlie's parents. I mean, this is, they're having to relive all of this. They stepped outside of the courtroom at one point when some of this video and the actual evidence of the killing itself, I can't imagine being in the courtroom for that if you were, I mean, even as a friend of Charlie's, but much less one of his family members. And you know, the commentary online, Gerard, I just think is so unnecessary.
No, it's disgusting. It's no one expects to be in a courtroom with a person who killed the love of your life, the father of your children, your partner. It's so disturbing that anyone would in any way demean what she's going through and the trauma that she's suffering, and the deep emotions that this brings. And she's really there to seek justice. She's there for justice. That's the purpose of this proceeding, is to bring the man who killed her husband to justice. And for anyone to be sitting there making comments that are in any way targeting Erica Kirk, it's just disgusting. This is not what we do. We need to have empathy for the victims. We need to have empathy for a life that was lost. We need to pray for the family, for the survivors. It's really shocking that in this day and age, someone could be so insensitive and post the sorts of things that we've seen being posted about Erica Kirk.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have to take a break here, but Gerard Folletti, really appreciate it, and we'll continue to follow this story, of course, throughout the week, and continue to pray, like I said, for justice for Charlie, because ultimately, while, of course, the defendant is entitled to due process and all of the protections that come with that, the point here is justice for Charlie when we're talking about the moral implications. And we just have to pray that there would be consistency by the judge, and that ultimately the jury would find the correct response to the evidence, and ultimately that justice would be served for Charlie and his family. So thanks so much, Gerard. You can follow him on X at Gerard Folletti, and we will be right back with more. It's been 4 years since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, but tragically, abortions have continued to rise. Today, the abortion pill accounts for more than 60% of all abortions, and last year alone, over 1.1 million babies lost their lives. That's why the work of Preborn Network Clinics is more urgent than ever. Every day, mothers facing unplanned pregnancies walk through Preborn's doors searching for hope. Instead of pressure and fear, they're met with love. Through a free ultrasound, mothers meet their baby for the very first time.
It was like the beginning of my healing journey. They do an ultrasound, and that's when everything changed. Because when I saw my baby, and when I heard her heartbeat, that was it.
Just $28 sponsors one ultrasound. $140 helps rescue 5 babies. To donate, dial pound 250 and say the keyword baby. That's pound 250 baby,
or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. So one of the unfortunate things, and beyond unfortunate, actually very evil things that happened over the 4th of July weekend is that Planned Parenthood's network of clinics regained access to hundreds of millions of dollars in Medicaid funding over the weekend, the fallout of Republicans' failure to pass an extension of the one-year defunding provision they approved last year. Remember that when they were saying, okay, well, at least this is a year, and we'll have a year to kind of fully defund. Well, where did that go, GOP? I think that they kind of put that on the back burner, and some of us, including on this program and others on AFR, had been warning, saying that this was coming, and the Republicans failed to pass that extension. And so the Politico headline is conservatives rage over refunding of Planned Parenthood. Well, yeah, and I think rightly so. But then Politico is also upset because they say despite the restoration of Medicaid funding for health care services, but not abortions, dozens of closed clinics are not likely to reopen. Well, good. Let's welcome in Father Frank Pavone, who is founder of Priests for Life and one of the best advocates for the pro-life movement. So where are we at with this, and why didn't the GOP get it together to at least pass another year extension? I mean, that's kind of kicking the can down the road, but at least don't let the funding come back.
Well, yes, that's right. Jenna, we are rightly and urgently concerned and calling for the complete defunding of Planned Parenthood. And I have been talking to members of Congress and including the Speaker and others, and they are, I mean, the clear indication I'm getting is this is something they want us to know. They're still working on this. Let's take a broad perspective here. First of all, of course, the funding wouldn't have been restored. We wouldn't be talking about the restoring of the funding if we hadn't had the tremendous victory of stopping it over the past year. Remember, that was something we worked for decades. And it's like many people in the movement said, just like they said, oh, we're never going to see Roe overturned. They thought defunding Planned Parenthood, you know, with this Medicare funding, of course, there's many streams of funding, but the biggest one with the Medicaid, they said, oh, this isn't going to happen, you know. But lo and behold, praise God, it happened. Now, if we had the original version, let's defund it for 10 years, well, then, of course, in the 11th year, we'd be having the conversation we're having now. We'd be saying, Nate, it's not enough to defund it for 10 years. We want to defund it permanently. And if we defunded it permanently, we would say, hey, it's not enough to defund it. We got to abolish abortion and Planned Parenthood, and we must. That is the urgency that's burning in our souls. But
yeah,
we are right now looking at the possibility of a third reconciliation bill. As you well know, and as I'm sure most of our listeners understand, this can only be done right now under reconciliation, a simple majority in the Senate. And we've already had two reconciliation bills. We're looking for the third one now, and that's the one where they want to put in this renewal of the, I like to call it the protection of our tax dollars from going to child killing. So it's still on the table. I also talked, one member of Congress was saying to me, hey, listen, you know, the fact that the deadline passed doesn't mean we got to give them the money the next day. You know, there might be ways of, you know, doing what the Democrats always do. Let's drag our feet here in giving any money back. So I don't know exactly how that works, but it's certainly something that's being discussed as well.
Yeah. So, you know, what confidence do you have that this is a priority for Congress, and especially heading into the midterms where, you know, the big question is whether Republicans will retain control of the House and maybe gain or possibly lose in the Senate? And so we have only a few months until November, and, you know, this really needs to happen before then, at least to preserve this, just in case, obviously, the worst happens and the Democrats take control of one or both chambers. So what confidence do you have that this is actually a priority for the GOP?
Well, let me make a distinction. I have a lot of confidence that there is a sincere priority in the minds of a whole, I would say the vast majority of our House members want to see this happen as we do. Is there a political side to it? Well, I think they realize two things, that number one, there's always a political cost but it's one that they you know, so many of them are willing to bear for standing up against the abortion giant. At the same time, there's a political cost for not doing it. I mean, it would be a great motivating factor for pro-life voters if, as we get into the fall, we hear that, hey, reconciliation number three has passed, and once again, Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry are defunded. They know that, too. I think the key is this. I again, by my direct contact with these people and many meetings that I've been in, I'm confident that there's a sincere desire to do this. But at the same time, what the priority is, and Jenna, you know this, I think our listeners understand this, but it's worth repeating, what the priority is for the members of Congress is not something we just sit back and say, well, oh, gee, what are your priorities? They work for us. What their priorities are going to be what the people's priorities are. And that's why what we're saying at Priests for Life to our people, and I know that you and your calls to action are saying this to all our listeners, is that, listen, when's the last time you put in a call to your member of Congress, both in the House and to your two senators, to say, I urge you, I demand as a voter that you take my money away from the abortion industry. If you haven't made that call in a while, please make it again. Make it as soon as you can. Let them. It's how much they continue to hear from us that's going to determine what their priorities are.
Yeah. And so well said that, you know, in the midst of all of these different priorities that clamor for our attention, and it seems like, you know, it's very difficult to be focused on so many things simultaneously. We need to be singularly focused on the issues that are at the core of what conservatives are advocating for. And one of those obviously is pro-life. And it's a really good question of when is the last time that you have called your specific members of Congress and your specific senator, or, you know, or even calling, you know, Leader Thune's office and Speaker Johnson, regardless of what state you're in, and saying this needs to be a priority. I mean, when was the last time Speaker Johnson was asked by a member of the media about this? I mean, Politico, yes, covered it, and a few other outlets covered it. But I think that the mainstream media and obviously the left really didn't want to draw attention to it so that Congress wouldn't act. And this just went into effect, ironically and unfortunately, on July 4th, as we were all celebrating America 250. And so how easy would it be for Congress to simply say, OK, we're going to defund this again for at least another year?
Yeah, exactly. At least another year, and we need our representatives to know that we want it for more than that too. We want it permanently. Look, we're talking about rightly so, waste and fraud, waste of our taxpayer dollars. A lot of waste and fraud are being exposed. What's more wasteful than giving, you know, $500 million a year and more to an industry that kills babies, harms women, lies to the people, commits all kinds of fraud and malpractice? And essentially, and they can go ahead and try to sue us if they want for saying this, Planned Parenthood is a criminal enterprise. It really is. There have been congressional investigations into Planned Parenthood and all kinds of things exposed in the ways that they, multiple ways that they break the law. And just the, I mean, the number one thing is the horror of abortion itself. But along with that, I always say, Jenna, you've heard me say, you can't practice vice virtuously. If your conscience is so dead and twisted that you can pull the arms and legs off of a living baby in the womb, you're not going to care about insurance fraud, OSHA violations, medical malpractice. You're not going to care about any of those things because you don't even care about tearing the arms and legs off a baby. So this has got to stop. And so we need to be bold and clear in what we're asking for. And we need to combine our commitment to principle and our boldness in calling for what is right based on God's word, also with a practical understanding of the limits of how lawmaking and politics work. And I find myself often needing to, you know, in the training seminars that we do through Priests for Life, needing to help people understand, hey, this political process, this lawmaking process, it is slow,
frustrating and very complex, and it's going up a hill backwards on a snowy day, you know. But it's what we have. It's what we have. It's the best that there is. We've got to constantly be improving it, but it's what we have. And I think that the deeper we get into the details of how these things work and the obstacles that even the best pro-life lawmakers face, the better it's going to be for us. You know, we're going to be a little less frustrated. And, you know, that headline you quoted before, you know, conservatives rage. You know, we have to rage. There's a rage that comes from a righteous anger. And at the same time, we have to make sure our rage isn't based on, you know, unrealistic expectations or a lack of understanding of how the political and lawmaking process works. You know, it is possible to combine both principle and pragmatism.
Righteous anger. Thanks so much, Father Frank Pavone. You can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Preborn has rescued over 400,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com/AFR.